From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with comedian Dennis Miller. He's the wisecracking, irreverent anchorman on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Also today, I talk with photographer William Claxton. His new book, Jazz, is a collection of his photos of jazz musicians taken in the 50s and 60s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from alto saxophonist Richie Cole. And television critic David Bianculli reviews TNT, the new syndicated TV series starring Mr. T. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
And now, Weekend Update with anchorperson Dennis Miller.
Dennis Miller has anchored the Weekend Update segment of Saturday Night Live since 1985. He delivers his topical humor in the form of a newscast.
Thank you. Good evening. And what can I tell you? While Wall Street suffered a down week, condom stocks continued to rise. I often hear people nowadays whine about the fact they have to wear condoms when they make love. This seems to me to be a rather minor argument. I'll tell you how I approach it. I wear two in my everyday life. When I go to make love, I take one off. I feel like a wild man.
Dennis Miller worked as a stand-up comic before joining the cast of Saturday Night Live. He hasn't given that up. He just finished a run at the New York comedy club Caroline's, and later this week he'll record an HBO comedy special. I spoke with Miller earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. The first anchor of Weekend Update was Chevy Chase. I asked Miller what he wanted to do differently than his predecessors.
I thought it was important not to look like I was worried about what they had done. It seemed to me that the error in doing Update in that five-year interim where the public perceived it not to work was that they seemed to be worried about how Chevy did it. I thought Chevy did it wonderfully. I mean, he invented it, and I think he's brilliant. He's a great guy. I mean, all that stuff is there. It's just that never once since I've been there have I really thought of him while I was doing it. I think if you look the least bit intimidated at that desk, the audience smells that it's like blood in the water. And they don't want to watch you because it's pretty pivotal position in that show. It's sort of the thing at midnight that whips it into the second hour, and you have to sit there and at least look like you're confident about it.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned confidence because you just exude self-confidence on that feature, and I don't know whether that's something you're really striving for, whether that's part of the act or whether you're naturally that self-confident.
No, that is part of the act. I mean, I'm as alternatingly confident and unconfident as any human being in my real life. But when I get to the desk, I try to manufacture it. I think it's important you look in control there. It's like when you watch The Dating Game and some guy's giving bad answers and you have to turn away from the screen. That's what it always reminded me of. If you're going to sit there, you might as well sit there and presume that you belong sitting there.
You don't want to be an inept bachelor number one.
Yes. That always made me cringe. So I figure, well, at least I'm going to go out on my shield if I have to go out.
I think you've developed Weekend Update into less of a place to spoof what TV news is like and more of a place to do political humor.
Well, I think that, it is less of a parody because I'm not really doing a news guy character there. The me that sits there is pretty much the me that does my stand-up or the me that does Letterman or Carson. You know, I don't really have a character up there. I don't do an impression of a newscaster. I'm just doing me reading the news. So I think it has become a little less of a parody of a newscast. As far as the political stuff goes, it's funny. If you strung together all political jokes there, I think you'd get buried. It seems like you have to intertwine these Weekend Update archetypes. Like, did you notice that Al Haig looks like Josie and the Pussycats drummer? You know, that sort of stuff. You know, you have to put those odd little jokes in there to keep it going. Because, you know, you can do the best political... I've done some political jokes up there that I thought were pretty good, and nothing. You know, it's pretty amazing. you know, I... So I think you have to make this nice mix of things that you know are flat out funny and things that are wise and witty about politics. It has to be some sort of mix of the two.
Do you want to give an example of something that you thought really worked well and you got no response?
Well, naturally, it's tough to pull a joke from the last 3 years, but I know there's been a couple that, you know, I've set up there, and, you know, I can't really give you a specific, but jokes you really put a lot of thought into, and, you know, the people just look at you and you think, I don't even know if they know what this story's about. I'm not saying the crowds are dumb, I'm just saying that if you get too involved in the minutiae of news, then they're not going to follow you. You know, they're not reading the paper like you are 5 or 6 hours a day, so you kind of can't go back that far into the pages and talk about an arms deal with Guatemala that went wrong, you know.
When Johnny Carson does a joke that bombs, he frequently makes jokes about the script writers. Now, you write all your own material. If one of your jokes bombs, what do you do to keep moving, to salvage it?
Well, you know, I write the great majority of it. I don't write all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody there contributes. There's some wonderful writers, and I wouldn't want to say that I wrote it all. Herb Sargent helps me a lot, too. He's been there since Chevy. If a joke bombs, I think all the audience demands off of you is that you acknowledge that it stunk. I don't think they want you to sit there and be presumptuous enough to act like it worked, because that kind of diffuses the whole mystique that you're aware of what's going on up there. I like to look very aware of what's going on at Update. I think a crowd almost finds it endearing if a joke goes up in smoke and you look at them and kind of give that nod, and it almost can be unspoken that you know that one didn't fly. They like that. But conversely, if I do that, I sometimes get nailed for laughing at things. Believe me, I've written enough jokes in my life that I don't sit there and laugh at my own cuteness. I kind of laugh at the ambiance in the room when a joke gets a big laugh. I think that's kind of a neat feeling. And if I want to celebrate that for a second, I'll also do that. So if a joke stinks, I acknowledge it. If a joke goes exceptionally well, I think it's okay to look at them and go, yeah, that was okay, wasn't it? And I think just that in-the-moment awareness the crowd sort of reacts to and seems to like.
How do you put the material together? Do you spend a good deal of the week reading newspapers and news magazines, things like that?
Yeah, I'm less anal retentive about it than I used to be. I used to sit there every day and digest the news and try to spit out a certain amount of jokes each night. And I found that was a little, that didn't feel right. It felt a little too binding. So what I do is I just read the papers and watch the news Monday through Friday. Friday, I sit down around 4 in the afternoon with a tape recorder, and I usually have this sort of comedic bulimic purge from 4 to 7 where I blurt out maybe 30 jokes onto the tape recorder. And I naturally think they're all brilliant and wonderful, and so I leave them on the tape recorder till Saturday morning when I listen to them and find out that usually 15 of them are absolute tripe. And I take the 15 that are left and have them typed up and put into the script. Try those at dress rehearsal. Usually burns 3 of them when you see they won't function on air. Usually go onto the air with 10 to 12 jokes that are they have a reasonable chance to succeed.
Do you have to run all this by standards and practices?
Well, anything that goes on network television has to be run by standards and practices. That's just the nature of the beast, but I've found them to be remarkably accommodating over the years.
Well, since you are lampooning real people, what are some of the guidelines you have to keep in mind so that you don't get sued?
I think the major guideline is that in our society over the last 3 years, it's become somewhat of a red badge of courage to be lampooned on Weekend Update, and to remember, if you're not patently cruel, they're not going to sue you, because they, in their own way, find it to be an inverse stroke that they've been ripped on Saturday Night Live.
They're important enough to be cut up there.
Yeah. I don't think people mind it unless you go for their loved ones or their, their innermost problem, something that's cruel, and I'm not a cruel person, so I pull things that I think might be too cruel, and I've never had a problem with anybody wanting to sue. I've had a couple stories over the years where I guess I missed the point and made a bad call. I guess that's going to happen, though, and I've received enough letters and you know, I've been, you know, people get angry, and that's going to happen. It's a pretty volatile forum up there. I guess you can't make mistakes, but as far as being sued, Jesus, I don't think anybody sits at home and goes, I'm going to get that guy. I think they think, oh, I'm on Weekend Update.
Comic Dennis Miller is my guest. He anchors the Saturday Night Live Weekend Update segment. You know, on last week's rerun, you had something about the Pope, and you said that during the Pope's tour through America that he stood over one of those heating vents, and you showed a photo of him. You want to describe the photo that you showed?
Well, it was a photo that had been cropped, the top of the Pope onto the bottom of Marilyn Monroe from that... I don't even know what the film was. I just... 7 year itch?
I think it's a 7 year itch.
Yeah.
But her dress is blown up.
Regardless, her dress is blown up over the subway grating.
I've had a lot of cartoonists tell me that the Pope is one of the most taboo subjects to lampoon in a cartoon. Did you ever have any trouble with that?
Yeah, I received some nasty letters about the Pope joke. I don't know. I didn't think it was that heinous an offense. I naturally think the Pope's a nice man and certainly an author in his own right, so I guess he understands the writing process. And I don't know. I guess it's the way you look at it. I didn't view it as that much of an attack on him. It was just that cute a picture.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody ever wanted to sit down with me and talk substantively about my feelings towards the Pope, they would certainly all be pro and a nice man, and I am Catholic, and... I have all those good feelings for him. I just never got to the point where I felt you couldn't poke a little fun at him. He seems to me to be just, you know, a man. You know, albeit a man with a good gig.
I always get the impression that you improvise some of your material, or at least some of the material between the lines, when you're doing Weekend Update.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a moment before you say an improvised line where you think to yourself, should I do this or not?
Well, yeah, there is, and sometimes you edit. But for the most part, I think if you get that instinct, it's best to go with it.
Is there ever a time you went with it and you regretted it?
No. I just don't think it's of that, you know, I don't think it's that critical a thing. You know, you go with it or you don't. I don't think you can regret it afterwards. I mean, it's... You really have to trust your instincts as a performer. I don't fancy myself as a great, great performer, but I think in the moment, I think pretty quick, and I usually trust what I say out loud. And I also know that I've set up a nice fail-safe system in my own head where anything that's that controversial or that on the edge won't get out, because I realize it is network television, and it doesn't pay to make such a radical point that you're going to end up getting burnt for it. So I've already set up a code in my head of certain things that won't get out, and they just don't.
Your hook is always I'm out of here. That's what you always say when it's over. How did you come up with that? It seems like it always helps people on Saturday Night Live to have a line that they're really associated with.
Well, you know, I'm not... that line is certainly... not caught on anything like John's That's the Ticket or Dana's Isn't That Special. So I don't think it's a catchphrase even. It's just a sign-off.
You're seldom in any sketches on Saturday Night Live. How come?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think I'm a wonderful actor. I don't know if I am or aren't, to be frank, because I've never done that much of it. But the fact is we have brilliant people there, and... the secondary fact is, in most sketches, I'd say there are two male leads, three maximum, and if you get down to the fourth, it's maybe me. But if you think about those first three, just for the success of the show, I'm not naive enough to see that the best three actors we have are Hartman, Lovitz, and Carvey. I mean, they're absolutely brilliant. Phil Hartman is, you know, to me, stunning. Lovitz is, to me, probably the funniest comedy actor I've ever seen in my life. He makes me laugh just outrageously. And Dana's like our rock star, you know? I mean, this guy knows how to hit the big beats. He comes in and he's like a cleanup hitter. He knows how to drive in runs. If I get an occasional part, that's fine. If I don't, that's fine, too. I see the show getting more successful, and I'm happy with that.
We're going to take a short break, Dennis, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is comic Dennis Miller, who anchors the Weekend Update feature on Saturday Night Live. He also has an HBO comedy special coming up. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Dennis Miller is my guest. How did you first get on Saturday Night Live? Did you have to do a formal audition?
I took over the studio at gunpoint one night. No, it's a pretty arduous auditioning process. It's kind of nebulous. It's not really defined. The thing I remember about it, looking back now, excuse me, is that it's very self-reliant process. Lorne kind of puts you up in front of a room full of people, the whole staff of the show, the writers, the production staff, and he just looks at you and says, you have 15 minutes, do what you want to do. And at the time I thought, Jesus, what a free-form idea that is. No direction, no, here's what we'd like to see, here's what we're looking for. Just go ahead. And I thought, my. And as I look back on it now, it becomes obvious to me that being in front of that many million people live each week dictates that you are able to think for yourself, and his way of seeing whether you can do that or not is to not give you too much direction in the audition process.
So what'd you do in that audition?
Well, I did stand up, I did my jokes, but more importantly, I tried to look like I was nonplussed.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes obvious to me that the thing that gets you that show is the ability to look at them right in the eye and not blink. And I didn't blink, but that's not to say I wasn't scared out of my mind, but I think there comes a point in your life, if you've looked into yourself enough, and I had spent much of the 20s trying to figure out what made me tick, that you see there comes a point where you simply have to throttle your self-destructive side in these auditions and do well, just because you should care enough about yourself to do well. So I remember going into that interview being very frightened and thinking, or, you know, the audition, thinking, oh, God, what if I don't get this? And all those incredibly seedy thoughts that you always think and you're about to blow it for yourself. And then I had this moment of calm right before I walked in where I took a few deep breaths and said, you know, you've worked very hard your whole life, and you're a pretty good person. You deserve this. I don't want to sound too Pollyannish here, but I had a moment of lucid thought where I remember thinking, you have to go in there and just look completely unflappable and just be a monster. You know, you have to be very funny and let them know that you can do this and you don't have any doubts that you can do this. And I went in, and I think in addition to the jokes being reasonably funny, I just looked like I could do it. You know, I gave that impression that I wasn't going to clam up if it came to that.
Well, you make it sound as if there had been auditions in your past in which you did things that were self-destructive.
Well, I don't think, you know, it's not as dramatic as you walk out in a petulant snit, but I think we all, in subtle ways, can self-destruct when the chips are on the table. I mean, we all had those pivotal crossroad moments in our life where self-destruction can even seem like self-pity. You can, you know, you can disguise and think, well, I've never gotten anything and I probably won't get this either, and the world really is shafting. You know, that stuff to me reads self-destructive in a way, because when you get away from it and have a clarity of thinking, you see that that crap shouldn't go in there with you. That's, you know, unimportant at that moment. All that's important is you do as best as you can and then let them make their decision. So, yeah, I've had that happen where I've gone into things and thought, oh, I can't do this, you know, and go, and it all comes out in the wash. They see that.
Your first year in 1985 ended up being one of the least successful years for Saturday Night Live. That was the year that Anthony Michael Hall, Anthony Michael Hall. Do I have the name right?
Yeah. I always called him Michael. I don't know what the order was.
Robert Downey, Denitra Vance, John Lovitz, you were all in that cast that year. And it was a year that was really torn apart in the press. I think the ratings probably went down. Mm-hmm. Did that blow your self-confidence for a while?
No, not in the least.
Did you have a lot of friends coming up to you, friends who meant well, critiquing what everybody should do on the show to make it better?
Uh-huh. Everybody does.
Did you want to kill them for that?
No. I remember when I was young, there was a comedian named Kelly Monteith who still works, and I saw him one night. I had yet to do comedy. I was like 18 years old, and he told me, there are going to be people coming up to you and telling you you're the best thing in the world. He's like, you can't listen to them. There are people who are going to come up to you and tell you you're the worst thing in the world, and you can't listen to them. But you do have to listen to the voice inside your own head that, you know, your taste alarm. How are you doing? I gave an honest effort in that first year. And as much as the working press and much of the public might hate this statement, I don't mean to sound overbearing, smug, or self-serving. I happened to like what I did. I didn't love what I did, but I liked what I did, and I worked very hard at it, and I felt comfortable with it. Therefore, when I would read in the press how horrible I was, I would think, well, fine, that's man's opinion. There's two ways you can go in life. You can choose to do something, or you can choose to appraise what other people choose to do. I just chose to do something, and therefore you leave yourself wide open to being appraised by people who chosen to appraise as their means of doing. And if a critic hates me, that doesn't even anger me. I don't know if I can make that differentiation. I don't sit there and stew about it. It just doesn't mean that much to me. I hope it means a lot to him. It's his opinion, and he should certainly value it. But it's not my opinion. And if my opinion ever told me I was doing horrible work, believe me, I would do something to right it. But my opinion that first year told me I was making an honest effort, learning the ins and outs of network television, and at moments was quite funny. At other moments, I wasn't funny, but I expected that to happen, too. I was just starting out. So when I would read the critics, it didn't really tear me up. You know, it might anger them in some way for them to think that it doesn't tear you up, but the fact is, I had finally gotten a job I had strived to have for years.
Right.
And was quite happy there, and couldn't really take time out of my own life to sit and be depressed because of others' opinions. I was enjoying what I had.
You know, one of the things that you're doing now, you're doing stand-up. I don't know if you had taken a break from doing the clubs or not, but I know last week you played at Caroline's in New York.
Mm-hmm.
This week you're filming an HBO comedy special and performance. Is it good for you to keep on doing stand-up even while you're doing Saturday Night Live?
Well, not only is it good, it merely is... It's what I'm about, you know. It's my raison d'être. I mean, it's what I do and what I'll always do. Stand-up is very important to me.
I've never seen you do stand-up. I've only seen you on the program. Can you give a sense of what kind of material you do in your club act?
Well, some of it's topical, so some of it's like the news, but it's more observations about life, things that interest me. Relationships, you know, and sex, and how the inadequacies of life and the incongruities, and you know, how cruel it can be one moment and how wonderful it can be the next. I guess that's the stuff of my humor.
Well, now I get to the really important question. You recently cut your hair after doing Saturday Night Live with very curly, wavy, shoulder-length hair. You recently cut it, and now it kind of rests securely behind your ears.
Yeah.
How come you got a cut? I always save that real heavy stuff for the end.
Yeah, you know, I've never even thought of it. I don't know why I grew it either, so I can't tell you that, but I don't know why I cut it either. Just, I got a haircut one day. But I'm amazed. You can't believe the mail you get. I mean, it's funny to me. It almost puts the whole television experience into perspective. I know sometimes these people who are given the keys to the hallowed kingdom believe that they're inside and it's some amazingly intricate, detailed, almost like a house of worship television is viewed as in this society. And the most letters I've ever gotten in my life is, why did you cut your hair? And if that doesn't put the whole thing in perspective, it's like you could write the best joke in the world. You could craft the most intricate, skillful you know, wise joke, and I wouldn't get one letter about it. But I cut my hair, and you've got hundreds of little girls and women, you know, why did you cut your hair? Why did you? I like your hair. Now. I like to, you know, it, to me, I remember reading these thinking, oh, well, I see what TV is about. It's about hair and eyebrows.
You said you could write the best joke and you wouldn't get any letters about it. But I'm sure you get a lot of letters about that.
Yeah,
that
but
day.
usually you get letters when people are angry.
Uh-huh.
Or you get letters about surface things. You don't get letters about, you know, specific jokes particularly. That just doesn't happen.
What do you think of as your greatest moment on TV?
Oh, geez, I'm glad you qualified that, because my greatest moment certainly wasn't on TV. You know, I remember the first time I did David Letterman. I had never been on television before in my life, and I was very frightened. I mean, you're backstage, and you're like in a rodeo shoot, you know, and they're about to open that gate, and you're about to jump out. And you've got 5 minutes to really distill and translate to the American public everything you've worked with for 4 years, 5 years. You know, it's very important to a young comedian to make that first score. And I was standing back there, and I was very frightened. And I walked out, and I hit that mark, and I looked at the camera, and my best moment on TV happened right then, and it was unarticulate, and nobody else knew about it. I took a deep breath and thought, oh, God, am I going to kill this? And I remember that moment, and to me, that's my biggest moment on TV, certainly a moment not shared with anybody because nobody else heard that. But in my head, all that work came together in one moment where I felt that I had prepared myself to the point that there was no way that this could not succeed and indeed kill. And that moment, you know, it was like a powerful, cathartic moment where you thought, oh, I see, all that preparation does mean something. It means you feel like you've got your valise packed. And there's nothing they can do to really derail you at this point. It's all in your court. It was an incredible feeling of power at that moment where you knew you were going to do well. Because up to then, it's kind of like, well, I do well tonight. But in that moment, I knew that I was about to kill it before
it even started. Did you?
Yeah.
How'd it go over?
And it went really well.
Yeah, okay.
So that was my most important moment. It was just a moment in self-confidence. It taught me something about yourself, that it's all right to feel confident. You know, up to that point in my life, I had always thought it was becoming to be sheepish and shuffle your feet and think, oh, God, I hope I do. And in that moment, I learned that it's all right to go, hey, you're going to do well here.
Well, Dennis Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dennis Miller. You can see him on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. And he has an HBO comedy special, Mr. Miller Goes to Washington, which debuts on February 27th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Richard Rhodes. His book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, recently won the National Book Award, and it's been nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, photographer William Claxton talks about the years he spent photographing jazz musicians in recording studios and clubs. His new book, Jazz, is a collection of his jazz photos from the 1950s and 60s. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Pop Bop, saxophonist Richie Cole's attempt to win new listeners to jazz by playing pop tunes and TV themes. And Mr. T's back on television in a new syndicated series called TNT. Our TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. The stock market defied gloomy predictions today and closed sharply higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 34 points to close at 1945.14, declined slightly outnumbered advances on volume of 159 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 40 cents. A federal court in Chicago today ordered Amoco Corporation to pay more than $85 million in damages for a supertanker accident off the Brittany coast almost 10 years ago. The Amoco Cadiz ran aground about 2 miles from the coast, spilling 223,000 tons of crude oil. The accident-coated beaches brought tourism to a halt and resulted in heavy cleanup costs for the French government. The award announced today is the largest ever in an environmental pollution case. About half of it is interest. A suspect in the April 1986 La Belle Disco attack has been arrested in West Germany. 3 people were killed and 229 were injured in the bombing of the West Berlin disco frequented by U.S. servicemen. Deidre Berger reports from Bonn.
27-year-old Christina Gabriela Endrichkeit was arrested in the northern German port town of Lübeck, West Germany, late last night. The tip came from a neighborhood resident after police made a nationwide appeal for information on the woman's whereabouts. Eyewitnesses have said she left the disco shortly before the bomb exploded. Berlin police suspect Endrichkeit carried the bomb into the disco under an agreement with convicted terrorist Ahmed Hazi. Hazi is serving a 14-year sentence in a Berlin jail for bombing an Arab center in Berlin. During his trial, links with Syrian intelligence agents emerged, as well as unproved suspicions of his involvement in the disco bombing. The U.S. originally accused Libya of arranging the disco attack and bombed 2 Libyan cities in revenge 10 days later. A U.S. embassy spokesman in Bonn today refused to say whether the arrest will change U.S. charges of Libyan involvement. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Bonn.
One Arab teenager was killed by an Israeli civilian today in the West Bank. The incident occurred after a group of Arab youths began stoning a car. The 2 men inside the car opened fire, killing the youth and wounding another man. Also, in a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank today, a group of civilians drove inside and fired gunshots into the air. A UN relief official said the situation there was deteriorating. The Soviet Union announced today that it will participate in this summer's Olympic Games in Seoul. The BBC's Graham Webb has more.
One by one over the past month, the Russians' allies in Eastern Europe have announced that they're going to Seoul. So there was not any real doubt but that the Soviet Union would go as well. And announcing what he said had been a unanimous decision, the chairman of the Soviet Olympic Committee, Mr. Marat Gramov, said it accepted the invitation of the International Olympic Committee to send a delegation to the Games in September. But the committee declared that it supported the North Korean proposal to hold the games in the north and the south of Korea, a proposal which the Soviet statement said would undoubtedly promote a more complete realization of the Olympic ideals. Mr. Gramov told a news conference here this afternoon that between 500 and 520 Soviet athletes would be taking part. Graham Webb, BBC, Moscow.
Arizona Governor Evan Mecham, indicted on felony charges, went before his state legislature today and admitted he has made mistakes. However, Mecham's State of the State address did not dwell on his battle to avoid impeachment or the push to hold a recall election. Mecham said he would increase spending, improve education, and fight to make Arizona a drug-free state, all without raising taxes. Mecham was indicted on charges that he concealed a $350,000 campaign loan. This is NPR News in Washington. I'm Mara Liasson.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of the latest album from alto saxophonist Richie Cole. Cole is one of the best known and most written about modern jazz musicians. He is an aggressive promoter of the music and a defender of bebop values. Kevin admires Cole's well-honed technique, high energy, and unflagging enthusiasm, but he has a dissenting opinion about Cole's music and its message.
Nothing makes me reach for the earplugs faster than hearing that somebody's putting the fun back into jazz. Not that jazz isn't fun. Any music born of an urge to mangle brass band conventions will always have a playfully subversive side. You can hear it in such humorists as Fats Waller, Dizzy Gillespie, and Lester Bowie. But if you try too hard to make jazz fun, you may just wind up making it tacky. A case in point is alto saxophonist Richie Cole, whose new album is Pop Bop on Milestone. Cole says he wants to bring jazz to the people. So Pop Bop contains a fashionably bland New Age alto solo and is littered with pop artifacts like La Bamba, Spanish Harlem, and the theme from Star Trek. Now, there's nothing wrong with playing unlikely material. 30 years ago, Sonny Rollins took There's No Business Like Show Business, I'm an Old Cowhand, and How Are Things in Glockamora, and made them absurd and captivating at the same time. But when it comes to wit, Richie Cole is to Sonny Rollins what Mel Brooks is to Jonathan Swift. Cole is astute to hear the bop potential in the Star Trek theme, but Rollins would never stoop to something as puerile as this.
Alto Madness, the final frontier. Its lifelong mission is to explore strange and exciting new worlds of music and go where no man has gone before.
Give me a break. In fairness to Cole, he knows his instrument, and he knows its history. Up to a point, anyway. The best and shortest piece on Pop Bop is his revival of a 1920s Rudy Weedoff novelty, Saxophobia. Saxophobia works because Cole plays the joke straight, something he rarely does. He forgets that great jazz isn't just a matter of technique and respect for tradition, or even a desire to do something different. It's a matter of good taste. Cole mucks up a couple of nicely played ballads with schlocky synthetic violins, and he has an unseemly taste for self-promotion. In interviews and liner notes, everything is Alto Madness this or Alto Madness that. Alto Madness being his catch-all term for anything he does. It's not a philosophy, it's a marketing gimmick. Cole's lyric to El Dorado Caddy, sung by Tim Hauser of the overbearing vocal quartet Manhattan Transfer, shamelessly puffs up the reputations of the singer and the composer both. I thought jazz musicians did their bragging on their instruments.
Say, mommy and daddy, this is El Dorado Caddy. Now, loosen up all of you cats and chicks, cause I'm gonna take you out. Your kicks, why you just lose your sadness while you cops of gladness, just digging on the licks of her alto madness. So I asked Leonard Feather, I said, Lenny, how was the weather? He said, El Dorado is just blowing up a fine cool breeze. So LD just relaxed and grew with ease and take another course of that vocalese. Now, Eddie Jefferson had the answer, so I called the Manhattan Transfer. They said, indeed, indeed, but you really need to read. Why, McFowdy's gotta read, that's all you need. So check out Richie Cole, cause he's your next to kid. Get up on the bandstand and fall right in.
Like Time Magazine's infamous 1946 article on bebop, El Dorado Caddy focuses more on hipster trappings than musical content. It's a marvel that a tireless booster of jazz like Cole should so completely miss the music's values. Throughout its history, jazz has had to fight the prejudice that it's overdone, unsubtle, culturally retarded. This sort of superficial excitement perpetuates those stereotypes. What depresses me is that the people to whom Cole spreads his message of jazz joy may think such vulgar displays are what the music's all about.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat Cadence and Jazz Times. He reviewed Richie Cole's new album, Pop Bop, on the Milestone label. You're listening to Fresh Air. As a teenager growing up in Southern California, William Claxton loved jazz music and taking photographs. He hung out in jazz clubs, talking with the musicians and shooting pictures. Later, he became one of the most sought-after photographers of jazz album covers and also did work for magazines and books. Claxton's work from the 50s and early 60s has been collected in a new book called Jazz, published by 12 Trees Press. These photos of musicians such as Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday, Sarah Vaughan, and Chet Baker capture the mood of the period. They are dramatically composed, shot in black and white, using existing light, and many are taken through a haze of cigarette smoke.
Most of these pictures were taken between 1953 and 1963, and that was during the big LP boom, when all of a sudden LPs were very important, and also the jazz recording boom, and most of the shots were in recording studios or on sound stages, and the backgrounds are pretty plain and bleak. But that was better for me in the sense because then the subject sort of jumped out at the camera.
I think knowing the musicians and knowing about jazz, you are able to get some really characteristic poses. There's a photograph of Bill Evans in which he's hunched over the piano. It's a very dark photograph, and really the only light is the light reflected off of his face. And his face is so bent over, it's nearly touching the keyboard that he's playing.
Yes, he was very concentrated. He didn't even know I was there. I don't think he was so concentrated in what he was doing. But I know that's, I love that picture because you only see just a few slight features, but it's just enough to know it's Bill Evans.
You have a photograph of Thelonious Monk at the piano. And it's interesting to me, he's not making eye contact with the camera. It looks like he's not really looking at anything, that although his eyes are focused outward, he's really just totally focused inward on what he's playing.
Yes, well, that was in San Francisco, and it was, we had to do a record cover, had to photograph a record cover, and we photographed a few things, like the record company wanted, out on a cable car and that sort of thing. And finally I said, let's just stop and have lunch. So we had lunch, and he had quite a few drinks and got relaxed. And he said, I know a hall we can go to. And we went to this big empty hall. We just walked in. No one was around. And he sat down, and he was just wonderful. He just gave me a personal, private concert right there. And he had that sort of vacant stare because I think he was feeling what he had taken inside. and also just concentrate on his music.
Were there a lot of very corny type of shots that were typical of jazz photographs that you really wanted to make sure you broke away from in your own work?
Yes, during that period, or just prior to the period that I got involved, I always noticed that the end thing for quote jazz photographs was always harsh flashlights and very contrasting pictures and lots of sweat and lots of distortion in the face of the musician while he's playing. And I didn't really see much of that. I walked in and into a recording session. Everybody was sort of gentle and pleasant and soft lighting, and it established a whole different mood and feeling, both, I guess, through my personality and how I saw it and the way things were recorded out here on the West Coast at the time.
One of your photographs is a scene outside of the club Birdland, the New York club, and a couple of people are walking into the club, and standing outside of it is a saxophonist who, I must say, looks very strung out. I don't know if he was or not. You say that the photograph was shot at 4 in the morning. Is there a story behind that photograph?
Yes, I'm afraid that was a setup shot.
Oh.
And I did it on purpose because I was trying to get the mood of New York at the time and the feeling outside of Birdland. And there was always a lot of young, rather sad musicians hoping to get into Birdland, either to listen or to play, and many of them couldn't even afford to get in. And I noticed that all the time. So I had this young actor friend, a fellow named Ben Carruthers, and he just stood around and I photographed him. And to get that mood, what was characteristic of what happened outside of Birdland during the 50s.
It looks very realistic, even though it's a setup.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about another photograph.
Mm-hmm.
You have a wonderful photograph of Charlie Parker surrounded by three of his fans. And he looks very happy, happy in a way that you don't usually see him in photographs. There's a big smile on his face. He looks very, very healthy, very well rested. What's the story behind that picture?
Well, I'd heard of Charlie Parker, but never seen him, and I was dying to see him. And this is also very, very early in my career. I was still going to school, and I was living at my parents' house in Pasadena. And I'd heard that he was at the old Tiffany Club down in Los Angeles, so I packed up my speed graphic camera, my 4x5 film plates, and dashed down there and spent the entire evening photographing him. And I got to meet him, and he was terribly nice. And at the end of the evening, around 2 or 3 in the morning, several of his fans and he wanted to go have some food. And then we couldn't find an all-night restaurant, so I invited him to my parents' house in Pasadena. And they were out of town. And he spent the whole weekend with us, with a little group of young people, and we just sat around in awe listening to him talk and feeding him and taking care of him and making sure he was happy.
Did you take more photographs of him that weekend?
Yeah, I took quite a few pictures. In fact, I always hate to talk about ones that got destroyed, but we had a lovely swimming pool, and it was a summer day. And at one point, I got a picture of him totally naked with just his horns standing on a diving board, smiling and playing. And that I had a flood in my studio several years ago, and that picture disappeared.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Do you believe in photogenic? Do you think that certain people are more photogenic than others?
Oh, yeah, of course. I think that happens. And some people respond to the camera much better than others, aside from being photogenic. But like Jerry Mulligan just innately knows what to do in front of a camera and still not be disturbed by your presence or by the presence of lights or cameras. And then, of course, Chet Baker, I guess, is possibly maybe the most photogenic jazz musician of all time. I don't know. I could never take a bad picture of him.
How did you start taking pictures?
Oh, when I was 13 or 14 years old, the boy that lived down the street was a amateur photographer and a very, very good chemist and physicist and scientific type fellow. And he took classes in photography, and he taught me. And I think I was always a voyeur anyway. I always liked looking through keyholes and cracks in doors and windows. And the camera just gave me a legitimate reason to do such things.
I'm wondering if the musicians who you photographed ever did things to protect things that they wanted to keep private, if they ever drew the line for you of what you could and what you could not photograph them doing.
Oh, I think so, yeah. I think that I was always a discreet person that way, too. I think that if I saw anything going on that that I'm sure a musician who did not want to be photographed doing. I just didn't photograph it. I'd put my camera down, and therefore they didn't feel threatened by me. They knew I wasn't going to do that.
I remember one musician, and I won't say who, telling me that on one of his album covers, that he was actually very, very high when it was photographed, and he'd been really sick right before the picture was taken, so he was never really happy with his album cover. And I wonder if you ever went through something like that, of photographing a musician knowing that they were not in good shape at the time the picture was being taken.
Yes, that happened quite often, in fact. But I never wanted to show anybody, and I still don't, in any sad moment. I don't like to see anybody, especially a talented, creative person as they're, nodding off asleep under drugs. I think I just don't have any reason to do that. And if I did do it, I wouldn't let it be published. But yes, I was around a great deal of that. And when I was quite young, it was amazing that I survived a lot of that because I was experimenting myself.
What do you think kept you from getting a habit yourself?
Being so young and impressionable, I probably would have been tempted to try it. But I think it was my first trip to New York as a young person, like 17 or 18, and being invited to a big party where I did see a very well-known musician at the time shoot up and keel over and die right in front of me. And that just put the fear in me. I would never do such a thing to myself.
The photographs in your new book are all from the 50s and 60s. Are you still taking photographs of jazz musicians?
Not very much. Only I'd like to. I thought I wouldn't want to. It's just that only when a record company calls me and says, hey, we'd like you to do a record cover, and then I go and see the artist and spend time with them and photograph them.
Well, seeing your photographs in print now, seeing this new book of your photographs, do you think that's going to inspire you to go out and photograph more jazz musicians?
I think so. I'm getting turned on again. I know I've been listening to more jazz because of it, and getting back in the groove again, as it were.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your photographs.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
William Claxton's new book, Jazz, is published by 12 Trees Press in Pasadena, California. Claxton is currently the art director for Motor Trend magazine. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we have a report today on the Soviet Union's announcement that they will begin pulling some soldiers, they're not saying how many, out of Afghanistan in May, which means they've set a date of sorts. And an interview with Sovietologist Jerry Huff on Gorbachev's proposal reported over this last weekend for a summit with the Chinese. The People's Republic is less than impressed. Apparently, Afghanistan is one stumbling block to a meeting. So is Cambodia, because the Russians support the Vietnamese occupation there and the Chinese are behind the Cambodians. And the stock market today, after Friday's plunge of 140 points, we follow a trader for the day to see what happened.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Television critic David Bianculli had originally planned to review The Thorns this week. It's a new comedy series created by director Mike Nichols that premieres Friday night on ABC. But then David previewed another new series, which is Recycling an Old Star, and he thought he had better signal an alert.
We interrupt this regularly scheduled TV review with a special report. Make sure you're sitting down because this news is going to be tough to take. Mr. T is returning to television. This doesn't even seem fair. As far as I'm concerned, one time in the spotlight for Mr. T was once too many. Some comebacks can be counted on, like Halley's Comet. Some are pleasant surprises, like Miniskirts or John Fogerty. But Mr. T? Come on. I'd rather live through the Archies again, or Tiny Tim, or anything. But Mr. T, the mohawked macho mumbler of the A-Team, has decided to mount a comeback in a new syndicated series that premieres this week. It's called, ready for this, TNT. But it's a dud. Gone are the gold chains and rabbit foot earrings that Mr. T wore on the A-Team. For his new show, he's got a whole new image. By day, he's T.S. Turner, a mild-mannered private eye who wears three-piece suits, glasses, and a bow tie. By night, though, he sometimes slips on combat fatigues, custom-made combat boots, and assorted leather and studded accessories. not to cruise bars, to fight crime. He's Wally Cox by day and Rambo by night. His daytime partner is a beautiful young lawyer named Amanda Taylor. That's where the TNT in the title comes from. But the twist is that she doesn't know anything about his commando-style nocturnal activities. In the show's introduction, Mr. T describes the arrangement like this.
I'm really not a bad guy. I believe in law and order, but the law ain't enough. I get impatient. And when I see nice folks getting hurt, I get mean. And when I get mean, I get mad. And when I get mad, I get bad. Don't tell my partner.
And if that's too complicated, the promo for the premiere episode provides an instant synopsis. It's like a rap music video for morons.
A ruthless gang.
What do you guys want?
Plays king of the hill.
Shut up.
They find a victim.
What are you doing?
And break his will. But these big shots are in for a big surprise.
Show who he's ready for me.
When T.S. Turner cuts him down to size.
And believe it or not, the show is worse than that promo. In the premiere, Mr. Turner, visits the owner of a health club who's shaking down the neighborhood.
Are you a member?
No, sir. Just a man who don't like the way you do business.
I don't recall ever doing business with you, Mr.
T.S. Turner. And it seems you've been leaning pretty hard on some people I know.
Oh, have I now?
And I want to know why.
Nice suit, big man.
Mr. T's mistake, though, was going there in his daytime duds. The next thing you know, the bad guy has taken the fountain pen out of Mr. T's suit pocket and sprayed ink all over his starched white shirt. One thing's for sure. When Mr. T was between jobs, he didn't take acting lessons. But when I was watching that scene, my mind suddenly became filled with all sorts of questions. When was the last time I saw anyone using a fountain pen? When was the last time anyone with such bad diction was the star of a TV show? Who in the world would watch TNT, aside from masochists? And why, oh why, did I ever give up my old job as a janitor? I had to empty trash then, but I didn't have to review it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with fiction and science writer David Quammen. His column, Natural Acts, which appears regularly in Outside Magazine, examines the diversity, complexity, and hidden beauty of the natural world. His new book is a collection of short stories. Rock historian Ed Ward will play us some songs by several top soul stars who got their start trying to sound like Little Richard. And book critic John Leonard will review a new mystery novel by Lauren Esselman. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.